Douglas Stewart is, it has been said, the star of 2020's hottest literary fairy tale. His debut novel, Shuggy Bane, was rejected by 32 publishers before winning one of the world's biggest literary prizes, the Booker Prize for Fiction. The title character, Shuggy, is the gay son of an alcoholic mother, Agnes. It's 1980s Glasgow, poverty-stricken and violent. The book is dedicated to Stewart's own mother, and it's been billed as an autobiographical novel. It's been years in the making, as Douglas Stewart explained.
Actually, when I started the writing of Shuggy Bane, it was about 10 years ago, and it took me about 10 years to write. You can probably tell I'm a Scotsman by my accent, but for the past 20 years I've lived in New York. I'm actually a knitter by trade, or a knitwear designer, and I have spent 20 years working in New York for all the big fashion houses in America. But about 10 years ago, or 12 years now, I sat down to write Shuggy Bane because I'd always had these furloughed dreams about being a writer and pursuing that. And the book just, I didn't have any expectations of it at the beginning. I sat and I wrote scenes that came to me as they came to me, so out of chronological order. But before I knew it, the power of what I was writing started to manifest. And before I knew it, I had a book.
You began writing, I read, with no intention to publish it. So what were you writing for?
Well, as you probably know, Shuggy Bane draws a lot on my own personal experience. I think as writers, we often do that. We draw from our lives. But I grew up poor and queer, the youngest son of a single mother who suffered with alcoholism my entire childhood and then lost her struggle with it. My mother's been gone for about 30 years now, Kim. And I think when I sat down to write the book, I was feeling a sense of loss and a sense of longing, not only for my mother and the world I grew up in, but for the city and for who I was as a boy. I think as an immigrant and as someone who was working in New York, I felt very far away from my working class Glaswegian roots. And so I was writing for some sense of catharsis, but also to reconnect two very different parts of myself, I think.
So at what point did you decide that this was in fact a book and not a kind of personal catharsis?
Well, really quickly, the book dwarfed me, meaning the story that I told really started to eclipse my own lived personal experience. And as you'll know, the book spans across the city of Glasgow and looks at about 50 years in the life of the Bane family, who are at the heart of it. But I just loved writing the book. And so I would rush home from the studio at night, or I would write in the mornings before I went to the design studio. My absolute idea of heaven was I would fly to China about four or five times a year. And that uninterrupted time on a plane was like a writer's retreat for me, and no one could reach me. And I would just spend the time thinking about my characters and writing. And so I'm not sure when it actually started to become a book or when I had an idea of it being published, because part of the 10-year journey was just about the pleasure of learning my craft and the pleasure of spending time with the characters. And so it was only towards the end of those 10 years, and the only person who'd actually ever read the book was my husband in all that time. And it was only really sort of towards the end of the 10 years that I thought, I have to let this go, because even as a person, I couldn't move on. I was giving so much of my life to it. And so it was only then that I sent it out to be published.
Did your now husband, whom you've lived with for over 20 years, I think, did he know any of this stuff, your background, before he read the book?
Obviously, in the pages of the book, we look at a lot of trauma. We look at addiction. We look at homophobia, some misogyny. You know, Glasgow's a beautiful and a proud city, full of really empathetic, caring people. But in the 1980s, it went through a really tough time under the Thatcher government, and unemployment in the city went to about 26%. And it was even worse in some neighborhoods and some housing schemes as Thatcher closed all of the heavy industry. You know, I think men from the west coast of Scotland are never really encouraged to talk about their feelings or about their childhoods. And so my husband, even though we've been together for 20 years and he comes home to Glasgow with me a lot, often maybe twice, two or three times a year, he didn't really understand what it was like to grow up there and to grow up with a mother who was disintegrating or in a community that was sort of coming apart. And so when he first read the book, I think it gave him a deeper insight into me as a man. And it was really just so eye-opening for him, I think.
There are many parts of the book that I've turned the page down on. One of them is a description of Shuggie's mother, who has passed out from the drink.
Mm.
And he turns her head to the side to stop her choking, and he takes her clothes off, and he arranges three mugs by her, one with the tap water and one with milk to line her sour stomach, and the third with a mixture of the leftovers of special brew and stout. And he knew that that was the one she would get first because it would stop her crying in her bones. Did you do that?
I think as a child of an addict, you learn many techniques to cope with their addiction. And so much of what is in Shuggie are things that had happened to me, or techniques or strategies I learned to help my mother and to care for her. When you are a child of someone who's suffering like that, the role inverts very quickly and you become the caregiver and you become the adult in the house in many ways. And so there are many small coping mechanisms that not only myself, but there was many parents struggling at the time, or especially women, I think, who felt very limited by what society could offer them and what it expected of them. And so I had many friends whose mothers were struggling or coming apart. And so much of the coping techniques are just really things we did to get by. And as a kid, you don't think about it. You know, you don't. It's only as an adult later that you look back and you think that was really odd, or that was kind of extraordinary. Because at the time, as a child, the remarkable thing about children is I think they just cope with whatever's in front of them. They have no ability to compare it, especially when you're living in poverty. I think you don't necessarily get to see much of the rest of the world. You just get on with what's in front of you. And certainly what's in front of you is love for a parent who's suffering.
How do you cope then with feeling love for a parent and realizing that the parent doesn't love you enough to stay alive?
Well, I don't think that's the actual question there, Kim, because I don't think that it's about a parent not loving a child to stay alive. I think what I wanted to show with the character of Agnes is that she is a really multifaceted person. We begin the book where we see her as a mother and a lover and a friend and even a foe. But she is a generous, glamorous, gregarious, determined, but also very troubled and frustrated person. And before we even sort of embrace her addiction, she is this, hopefully the reader feels this, she's a very multifaceted woman and complex. And so her sort of, it's not about her love for Shuggie that sends her into addiction. I think it's the hurt she carries inside her. One of the pivotal moments at the beginning of the book is when her husband, under the guise or under the promise of realizing one of her dreams by moving her to a new council house, a new government house, but finally they'll have a front door of their own, they'll have a garden for the kids to play in, uses that moment to brutally abandon her and essentially maroon the character of Agnes and their three children in a North Lanarkshire mining town that has been closed through all the pit closures. And Agnes carries all of that hurt inside herself. And so I don't think it's about her feelings about Shuggie, because I hope the reader sees in the book that this is actually a love story. And it is about the tenacity of love. And it is about the power of these two souls and how they sort of get up every single day and keep going. But she is a character that carries disappointment in herself. And her drinking harms her first before it harms anyone else.
Do you think I'm being judgy when I ask you how you coped with a parent who didn't love you enough to stay alive?
No, I don't think you're being judgy, but I think I don't know what your own personal experience with addiction is. And I've always known that it has so little to do with other people other than the person suffering. I spent much of my childhood trying to devise strategies and be quieter or brighter or neater, or just get in front of my mother's addiction with some kind of initiative, as if I could turn her towards me and turn her towards hope. And at the end of the day, the struggle rages inside the addict themselves. And it has nothing to do with how they feel about you. It has everything to do with how they feel about themselves and how they are coping. And it can take a lifetime to learn that. And certainly it took me a while to learn that. But I believe that to be true.
Yeah. I mean, every child of a parent suffering from some addiction will feel to some extent what you're saying, but the kind of unconditional love that you accorded your mother, that Shaggy accords his mother, strikes me as extraordinary, just extraordinary. Because most children, they reach a point where they will turn away.
Yeah, and actually that's one of the central themes of the book. I mean, one of the questions I hope the book raises is how far will you go to save the person you love the most before you save yourself? And we see Shuggy's older siblings do that. Shuggy is actually the youngest of three, and his elder sister makes a decision quite early on in the book. And his brother, who is actually, I think, the real hero of the book, he is the middle child. He's called Leek. And he's this beautiful, gentle, sensitive, kind soul in this very hard patriarchy. But he furloughs or he puts aside all of his own dreams in order to take care of his mother and his brother without ever making a big declaration of it. He just does it and doesn't ask for anything in return. But even he has to make a decision. And can he save Agnes? And can he stay by her side? And I think that is a part of what it means to love an addict. I think it is a point that many of us come to. But the difference between Leek and Shuggy as characters is Leek harbors an anger because he understands the beautiful, vibrant person his mother was before addiction. And he understands all the promises and the dreams that their life had and are starting to come apart. Whereas Shuggy only understands his mother. He was sort of born into her difficult times or her difficult years. And so that's his entire universe. So he can have no anger because he has no context. All he can have as a child is love.
That was what I was going to ask you, really. When you think back to your childhood, what's the overwhelming feeling? What colour is it?
Oh, I mean, it's so hopeful and it's so full of love, my childhood. And please remember that the book is a work of fiction.
Yes, so, of course, and that's why I'm treading that careful line. I know. But your childhood.
Yeah. My childhood was, it was a complicated time. I think something about the Glaswegian spirit is you live life on the front line. There isn't a lot of distance between you and reality. And that's part of the charm of the city. But what that means is life can be quite blunt sometimes. But it was a time of a lot of good laughs and love. But then there was an awful lot of sadness. There was a lot of violence and tenderness at the same time. And there's a lot of sort of sadness with humor. You know, the Glaswegians have an incredible sense of humor and a way of just sort of looking very clearly at life and stating it as plainly as possible. And part of writing Shuggy Bane was to take these really opposing feelings or emotions or just the humanity of it and jam it together and make it sort of collide with each other. I think sometimes when I talk about the book, it can sound like a sad book because we're looking at addiction and we're looking at loss. But actually, it's a very funny book, I hope, and a very sort of real book. And all I really want is for the reader to come to it with a sense of empathy and then feel moved by it.
Empathy, yep, for Agnes and for Shuggy. But Shuggy's father is a brute that I found it very hard to have any empathy or compassion for. What about you?
Big Shug is a Protestant taxi driver in the book. And Agnes has done something in Glasgow that was controversial for the time. She is a Catholic woman and she's married across sectarian lines. She found Big Shug at the beginning very glamorous or sort of shiny in a way. And he turns out to be a really bad apple. He is a philanderer. Philandering is actually too nice for what he does to the women across the city. But he spends most of the first part of the book sleeping with Agnes's friends and using women in the roughest of ways as he drives his taxi cab across Glasgow. I actually didn't know my own father, Kim, so this lets you know where fiction sort of diverges from autobiographical fiction. And so Shug is absolutely a fabrication. But I grew up as a young gay boy in a world that was controlled by men. And I saw a lot of violence. I saw a lot of the way that men thought about women and thought about certainly queer people. And it was a sort of very limiting, narrow time for everybody. But that's a problem with the patriarchy. It hurts everybody. We tend to think it hurts children and women, but actually the hurt starts with men. And because men are only allowed to be an incredibly narrow sort of way, then it's women and children that suffer because of that. And so Shug is really an embodiment of that sentiment. He is, as a lot of the men in the book are, he is just sort of showing what that was like at the time.
So men were brought up to be men and go out and earn a crust and do the heavy lifting, and then came Margaret Thatcher.
Mm. Yeah, and actually there's a line in the book that talks about how she takes away all the jobs and, you know, industry is lying around like the bones of dead dinosaurs across the city. And that is true when you think about the shipbuilding, you think about the coal yards and the rail yards. But it also talks about how she, as a woman in power, is emasculating the men. And that is also true. That was an overwhelming sensation because I come from a long line of tradesmen or laborers who believed in good, hard work. And that's how we made our living. And then suddenly the men had nowhere to turn when, because of the Conservative government, they closed shipbuilding, steelmaking, coal and the railway works all in a very short period of time. And so even the men couldn't leave one industry and turn to the other. And it had so many knock-on effects, but one of the most profound knock-on effects is it lowered life expectancy by 14 years. And that, for one of the richest countries in the world, I think is an enormous point of shame.
I'm talking to Douglas Stewart, whose first novel, Shuggy Bane, has won this year's Booker Prize for Fiction. The word gallus comes up a lot in the book. What does that mean?
Gallus, depending on who yields the word, has two different meanings. It is a sense of absolute self-confidence, or when someone just feels so right and so put together and so cocky, then they have a sense of gallusness about them. But sometimes it's used on the lips of characters who are judging a person and saying, she has no right to feel so gallus, or why do you think you're gallus? Why do you think you're so brilliant? But it is this sort of innate sense of your own sort of fabulousness.
Did you have that in the end? I mean, you were unable, like Shuggy, to go to school because you were looking after your mother. And yet you graduated from high school, the first person in your family to do so, I think. You graduated with an MA from the Royal College of Art, and off you went to work for Calvin Klein in New York. Was that gallus?
That was determination, I think. I think when I didn't know my father, and so when my mother died when I was a kid, I was left by myself. I had very loving siblings, but you can't sort of build a life as a young man annexed to your siblings. And so I had to sort of strike out. I'd seen the city brought to its knees by all the sort of trades that my brothers and my uncles and my brother-in-law put their faith into just sort of evaporate. And so they were figuring out what to do with their training and their skills. And so I clung to education, and I was grateful. You know, even when I was in high school, I had to go live in a boarding house with these men that were in their 60s and 70s. And I had a room in the house, and I would have to work four nights a week, all day, Saturday and Sunday. But I had to drag myself up every day and go to school because there was nowhere else to turn. And so no one could really tell me what education would bring. But I knew that all the other paths were blocked to me, if that makes sense, Kim. And so I just sort of I clung to it in a way. And I'm so grateful that I grew up in a country that allowed the most impoverished kids access to education. Because certainly now living in America, I don't think that is the case here. You know, you have to pay for whatever you get here. And Scotland in the 80s and 90s allowed you to go to university and would pay for you, especially if you couldn't afford it yourself.
Did you, in fact, work at a deli counter in the supermarket?
Actually, I didn't. I, in fact, worked in a DIY hardware store.
That's good. So I don't need to ask you whether on particularly low days you did fold all types of your bodily discharge into the terra macerata.
No, I just have a very good imagination. I can imagine the rage that Shuggy would have felt, or the feelings of inferiority he feels in the beginning of the book, where he is this working class boy with all this potential, but there he is on a deli counter being bossed around by these middle class people who want him to handle their chicken in a certain way, but actually not use his hands, and just all these really complex feelings of class. But that is a completely fictional scene.
So there you are in New York, working for the top brands, expensive labels, as you say. Did you never feel weird about that, given where you came from? I mean, these people with too much money.
I mean, I felt deeply weird, but I couldn't diagnose it at the time. When I graduated from my degree in London, it was just enormous good fortune that I was offered a job at Calvin Klein in New York. And for all of my peers and everyone else who went to design school with me, it was an enormous opportunity to work on these luxury goods that were so both beautiful and expensive. And I never quite understood why I was unhappy for the years that I was there. I'm not talking about Calvin Klein, I'm talking about working at the luxury end of the market. And it only dawned on me later, much, much later, when I actually went and worked at The Gap. And there was, not to big up The Gap, but to say that when suddenly you have to use your skills and you're designing things that everybody can afford, there was a democracy to that that just sat correctly with me. And I realized, even as someone who'd gone to design school, my entire childhood had been about buying clothes out of catalogs. And even a school shirt or a pair of trousers were something my mother would be paying off for a year and a half. And so I just never felt right at the luxury end of the market. I just didn't understand why I was there or what motivated the people that were buying the clothes. And it was only until I could create things that even my family could relate to that I felt better about myself.
When you grew up in Glasgow, 80s, 90s, do you remember anyone who was gay and out?
I didn't know. I don't think I met a gay person until I went to university. And actually, part of the sadness was after I left high school, many, many years later, through the magic of social media, other kids from my high school reached out to me and said, "Oh, I'm gay too." And they had done because I was so bullied for just being effeminate and a bit precocious. I was such a target on the landscape, I guess you would say. And they sort of hid themselves. And so we couldn't even have solidarity in that. But I didn't know anyone else that was gay. And of course, gay people at the time in the media or on television were always such a point of comedy or such a point of, you would joke about them. And think about all these great effeminate comedians that come up in the English tradition. And so there weren't even role models in the media to be able to look at.
And when you got to America, was that a kind of huge liberation for you?
Yeah, actually, my liberation started before that. Part of studying at Textile College in Scotland was actually I was the only boy, I think, in my year or in my course. And I think the ratio of the college I ended up going to was about 15 women to every one man. So incredibly female dominated. And I just enjoyed that. I enjoyed the safety and the encouragement and just how sort of nurturing that was as an environment. And so at like 18 or 19, I really could begin to sort of find myself.
Why textiles, by the way?
Well, that's a great question. I actually didn't know what textiles were, but my high school teacher saw this wee boy that was just struggling to go anywhere. And my academic record was in tatters between looking after my mother, the bullying, and just, the day-to-day hardness that all the kids were bringing to school, because it wasn't just about myself that was suffering. It was a community that was having a really tough time. And so we were all just trying to get through it, I think. But certainly academically, I was in no great shakes to go on and study something like English. And so my teachers just saw this creative kid and turned me towards the arts and turned me towards textiles, because at the time, textiles was a very proud Scottish industry. I mean, what do we make if not whiskey and cloth? If you think about knitwear or tartan or tweed or Ayrshire lace. But I go and study textiles. And even by the time I come out of my textiles degree, that industry had sort of left the country and gone to the Far East.
I see that your third novel, you've written your
You're
second
really
one.
You're really jumping ahead.
Yeah, you've got the second one under your belt already. Your third one is going to be something to do with the demise of the textiles industry. Is that right?
That's right. That's sort of a background theme of what I'm writing about. But it's right that even though people understand me as a debut novelist, I've actually now been writing for about 14 years.
Overnight success, as they say, Douglas. Overnight success.
Nothing feels overnight. So I've been building up a body of work. But I was really lucky last year before we all had to shelter in place, I suppose. I spent 2.5 months on the Outer Hebrides, which is the archipelago of islands in the very north of Scotland, incredibly remote. But it is where Harris Tweed comes from, which is a world-class cloth. And I was just met with such warmth and openness by all the islanders. And I went there to sort of research the cloth and research how people lived and the history of the islands, and with the hopes of turning that into a book.
I read a short story of yours in The New Yorker called The Englishman, where a young man called David... He comes from the Hebrides, doesn't he?
He does, yeah. I wrote two stories for the New Yorker this year, actually, because something I was trying to get at or set on the page as a matter of history in a way was that feeling of growing up gay in a remote place before the internet. It always shocks me when I talk to my young gay friends now, and they have no concept of what that is, because of course we're all so connected. No matter where you live, you can turn on a screen and find your tribe or find like-minded people to yourself. But back at the end of the 80s and the 90s, it was such an isolating time, and you, unless you could strike out into a big city and also be amongst those types of people, then you couldn't find your own folk. And so I wanted to write some short stories about it. But David comes from the Hebrides and finds himself, he's answered essentially what's a help wanted ad in the back of a gay paper, and he ends up in London working for an Englishman who has intended for more than just help wanted. And it's about the sort of the conflict that David's naivety brings with the Englishman's exploitation, I suppose.
Shades of, I know on your finished book, there is a blurb which says this is the counterpart to the privileged Thatcher era London of Allan Hollinghurst's The Line of Beauty. And it certainly isn't Allan Hollinghurst's milieu. But there's something that reflects on the Hollinghurst life in that story, The Englishman, is there not?
There is. I think it's always hard to find. We are underrepresented as working class voices in literature. And I think as we're having these conversations about diversity, Kim, we also have to take into account class. Hollinghurst is one of my favorite writers ever. He was one of the very first queer writers I wrote, but he writes from a very upper class milieu or a point of view. And so when he is talking about the Thatcher's year and years in his work, he talks about it with such, I don't know, affection and positivity. And here's this kid growing up in Glasgow that knows unemployment was 26%, that knows drink and drugs swept in when Hope left town. And so I never wanted to sort of add more to that. I wanted to really rebalance the historical lens by showing, yes, Margaret Thatcher was a very determined, very forthright woman, but we have to also look at the effects of the policies she made. And so to look at queer life at the working class lens is, I hope, is a counterbalance for what has historically been the focus of literature.
Have you given up your day job now?
I have given up my day job. I've been working towards writing for so long and quietly for so long that when Shuggie was actually accepted as a manuscript, I thought I would just really want to be present for this and give it all of my attention. And so I stepped away from fashion in 2018.
Was drink ever a problem for you, personally?
No, that's a good question. Drink has never been a problem for me personally. I drink hopefully a normal amount, but I was always raised to understand that none of us know what's coming next. You know, as long as we're all still in the world, we're all still in the world. And I don't think anybody that succumbs to addiction and necessarily knows that's what the future holds for them. It can creep up on us, it can be unexpected. And so I think I go through the world hoping that the thing that sort of tilts me or tips me towards addiction never comes. But so far, I don't have a problem with any substance.
That's always the question, though, isn't it? Whether addiction is circumstantial or whether you create the circumstances via the addiction.
I suppose so. I've known it to be both, I think. I don't know that it's necessarily one or the other. I certainly know it to be a quicksand, and it's incredibly difficult to get out of once you fall into it. But for instance, I show in the book at the very beginning that the character of Agnes is loved. She's adored. She is perhaps the most adored woman in the entire novel, and her parents spoil her and fawn over her and focus all their energy on her. And even men adore her, and her children certainly adore her. And yet it still sort of disintegrates or crumbles for her, partly because of what her husband does, but also because I think the time just wouldn't rise up to meet her dreams. And I don't think as a child Agnes would have ever seen that coming, nor would her parents.
There's a terrible piece in the book, of course, where Agnes is, she goes to AA and she's sober, I think, for a year, and then she gets a boyfriend who says, you're fine, you're cured now, have a drink. You just know what's going to come of that. It's a terrible, terrible thing. Can you tell me whether that has echoes in what really happened?
That doesn't have echoes in what really happened, but what it is a comment on is Agnes, after sort of being abandoned by her husband, goes through a long period where she doesn't date anyone else. And then this most marvelous man arrives on the scene who also drives a taxi and kind of rushes into the book, almost like a white knight in a black hackney carriage. And I wanted the reader to sort of feel that upswing of hope that Agnes feels. And certainly things for a period are just beautifully optimistic. And Agnes is sober and looking towards the horizon and happy. But it's really a comment on how men affect women, how they sort of control. You know, Eugene says things to Agnes that, you know, you are fine. You're better than an alcoholic. Look at how you look. Look at how you are. Of course, you don't have an addiction. How can a woman as beautiful as you be suffering like this? And, you know, it's a comment on how Agnes perhaps didn't have enough self-confidence in herself to say, thank you for that, but that's really bad advice. I don't want to take this drink. But it's also, in a way, sort of influenced by my love of Thomas Hardy novels. When we think about Tess of the D'Urbervilles and how that book is almost anchored around her relationship with all these different men and how she passes through the book in that way, it was still true in 1970s and 1980s Glasgow that Agnes's relationship with her father would sort of transform into a relationship with her husband and then a relationship with her boyfriend. And that really speaks to what we allowed single mothers like that to achieve.
Famously, then, your book was rejected by 32 publishers before winning the Booker Prize. Every putative writer loves stories like that. 32 times, though. I mean, did you change it in the course of that in order to try to get it accepted, or did you just keep submitting it as is?
I did not change one single word. It didn't matter that the book was rejected. And actually, rejection's an important part of the writing life. You will always be rejected. In fact, Shuggie is still being rejected by international publishers. So I wouldn't want anyone to think that the Bookers changed those things. But you know, you'll be rejected by editors, by agents, by readers, by critics. And the challenge is, as a writer, to write on and keep going and believe in what it is you have created. But rejection also serves as a tool to find your champion. It's hard to publish a book. It's hard to publish a new voice. And all that rejection really brought me to the publishing house that Shuggie needed to be at, that really believed in my work as much as I did. But it was also personally sad at times, because a lot of the rejection was because they didn't know how to market a working class voice or a working class story, or who would this appeal to? And as we've since proven, it appeals to everyone all around the world, and so they were wrong in that. But I think that's another way that that shows you that diversity in all forms of media is really important.
But didn't your countryman James Kelman show the way on that?
He did. And I mean, I think sometimes that flattens the conversation, because people say, I'm the second Scotsman to win the Booker, and James won it in 1994, I believe. That's a 26-year gap. But in between that, there are really urgent, dynamic, critical voices every single day. It's just that we are the two Scottish voices that won the Booker, but there are great books being published every single day. I think it's not the responsibility of a prize to promote diversity in publishing, but I think it helps. The responsibility for diversity in media lies with us and what we consume and the stories we're curious about and what we manufacture. But certainly the Booker is a really important sort of indicator of change like that.
And that was Douglas Stewart, whose book Shuggie Bain won the Booker Prize for fiction a couple of weeks back.